to receive the Local Government Manawatū Whanganui Region Reorganisation Order 1989, which provides that, as from 1st November 1989, the present Palmerston North City shall be abolished and the Palmerston North City Council shall be dissolved, and that there shall be constituted, one, a district to be known as the Palmerston North City, comprising the area of the present Palmerston North City, the present and part of the present Manawatū District and part of the present Arua County. Two, a territorial authority to be known as the Palmerston North City Council.
We will move that that information be received. Moved by the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Ford, seconded by Councillor Chettleborough. There being no discussion, I'll put the motion. Those in favour will say aye. Contrary, no. The motion is carried. We will also receive the schedule of mayors, deputy mayors, councillors and departmental heads that have been associated with this organisation from 1877 to the present day. Moved Councillor Robson, seconded by Councillor Pengelly. The motion is that the schedule be received. Those in favour will say aye. Contrary, no. The ayes have it. Councillors and distinguished guests, when Mayor Brian Elwood vacated this office 4.5 years ago, I knew that substantial reorganisation of local government was going to be a certain consequence of that appointment, particularly if the then Labor government was returned to office, as indeed it was in 1987. Like all drivers of motor vehicles, the accident is always going to happen to someone else. And it was with sublime confidence that I assumed that nothing would happen to the Palmerston North City Corporation. It certainly never occurred to me that within 5 years of that time, I would be presiding at the last meeting of a council that had evolved over a period of 112 years and which was to cease its legal existence within the next 3 weeks. It would seem appropriate, therefore, to highlight some of the major milestones of the council in the last 112 years. Council first came into existence in 1877. It was an isolated village set in bush and native forest, and which largely covered the then inland Manawatū district. Sawmilling was the main industry of the town, with three mills at work, and towards the end of 1877 had a population of about 800 people. There were, of course, no proper streets, sewerage systems, water supplies, electricity, gas, parks, library, or indeed any of the modern amenities that we now take for granted. Roading, of course, was the first priority for this new council. The town had 28 miles of streets dedicated on the plan, but only 6.5 of them were formed and metalled, the other streets being identified only by survey pegs in the bush. The borough in total had a rateable value of £6,400, and the rates the borough council collected in its first year were £339. The unsatisfactory state of the roads and the stormwater drainage caused a loan for £10,000 to be raised in the very next year, and by the time that money was spent in 1883, most of the roads had been cleared of bush, roughly formed and partly metalled. When the loan was raised, there were then 361 ratepayers paying an average of just under £2 each in rates, and their loan indebtedness was equal to £27. By 1879, a library had been created. 4 years later, the fire brigade was formed, and while the fire brigade grew in strength, unfortunately, the library went into recess in 1886. But a town hall was purchased for use as a public meeting place and as council offices. And by 1885, just 8 years after its formation, council was brave enough to raise a public works loan of £50,000 to build a public water supply, and this was the first dam on the Tiritia stream, and which was opened in 1889. A primitive sewage disposal system was created, but it just fed straight into the Manawatu River around about where the Fitzherbert Bridge is. And the balance of the money was spent on further improvements to streets and stormwater drainage. As you see, nothing much changes. The profligacy of the borough council was something that I actually marveled at. But as our archivist and historian Ian Matheson recalls in his notes, New Zealand was part of the glorious British Empire, bringing prosperity and civilization to the world. Victoria was on the throne, God was in his heaven, and the future was rosy, and one could borrow with safety. The world was advancing, of course, with the telegraph and the steam engine. And so it was that by 1902, at the end of the first 25 years, the population had reached 7,000 people, and the borough was becoming an important agricultural service centre, supporting a prosperous dairy industry and a booming sheep farming community. The slow but steady start that the first 25 years recorded became a springboard for the next 25 years, during which the population grew from 7,000 people to 18,000. It was during this period of time that Palmerston North became firmly established as a leading provincial centre and at the hub of a network of railway and roading lines. All major streets were reformed with modern road building techniques. You know, that's layers of stone, large ones at the bottom, smaller on the top. And the borough had by then purchased a steamroller and a metal crushing plant, which was located at the Albert Street Depot, the centre of the council's works activity. Street sealing commenced in 1911, and all major streets were sealed over the next 20 years. Yet another dam was erected on the Tiritia stream, first to a height of 22 feet, and then 6 years later was raised to 50 feet. And with the introduction of the first filters in 1913, the town had a much improved water supply. Sewerage discharge into the river, I'm pleased to say, ceased in 1905 when septic tanks were built at Awapuni, and a network of pipes were laid throughout the borough within 2 years of that time. The system was designed by Samuel Jickel, the council's first time full-time engineer. Although the library was re-established in 1900, the building that many of us still remember was on the corner of Fitzherbert Avenue and the square, was actually constructed in 1929 and of course remained as that until it was vacated and demolished and is now the National Mutual site. The Opera House, much in discussion at the moment, was erected in 1905 at a cost of £9,500 and has provided the city with a large public auditorium for over 80 years. This was also a period when parks and reserves were being developed. A sports ground in Fitzherbert Avenue was developed in 1900 along with the Esplanade Gardens. Public swimming baths were first built in Ashley Street on the site of the present car park, and this was opened in 1917. All the trading undertakings of council were commenced in this, or acquired in this particular period. Although gas had been supplied, the gas works were finally purchased from a private company in 1915 and rebuilt in 1923. The abattoir was purchased from a private company in 1917 and remained as a prominent landmark in Maxwell's Line until 1969. Now, the bus service commenced in 1921 after 9 years of debate as to whether the town should install an electric tram or petrol buses. And as history shows, the petrol bus supporters won the day. By 1924, the need for electricity had been recognised, and the powerhouse at Terrace End complemented an extensive reticulation throughout the borough. The whole system cost £185,000 and generated sufficient power for many years to meet the needs of the borough and until bulk power was able to be purchased from the government by the Manawatu Arua Electric Power Board. Of tremendous importance, though, in this particular period was the development of education in the district. Now, as early as 1906, the council was lobbying government for the establishment of a dairying school. And the council gave a site for such a school on the corner of Park and Botanical Roads, more or less where the Awatapu golf links were, which is now, of course, a school and a subdivision. Government did not proceed with that proposal, and the land was returned to council. But in 1926, the council again lobbied the government, but this time for an agricultural college, and the ratepayers of the day agreed to raise a loan of £10,000 to purchase a property at Fitzherbert for gifting to the government. The government of the day accepted the offer, and Massey University Agricultural College was established. Clearly a most significant and forward-looking move by the borough council of that day. Thus, at the end of 50 years, the Palmerston North Borough was a prosperous town, well equipped with water, sewerage, gas, electricity, sealed roads, parks, library, and with an acceptance that Massey Agricultural College would be established. The next 25 years, of course, brought very, very few milestones in its development. This was the period 1927 to 1952, and included the Depression of the 1930s, the World War of the 40s, with all the consequent restrictions throughout that period. The only major addition to city amenities was the purchase of the aerodrome in 1937, although the airfield had begun to be used in 1936, when Union Airways Limited established a link between Auckland and Dunedin, flying via Palmerston North and Wellington. And it was that particular development that led the City Council to purchase the airfield, to improve the runway, and believe it or not, the terminal building. However, it was very early in this period that the city reached then its magical 20,000 population and had city status bestowed upon it by the Governor General in 1930. Now, the next 25 years and those immediately preceding the centennial was characterized by the tremendous boom when population rose from 31,000 in 1952 to 58,000 in 1977. The city had diversified its economic base with the tremendous growth of Massey University and the associated research institutions of DSIR and DIR, and along with the industrial development on the northern edge of the city after the relocation of the railway up to Tremaine Avenue during the 60s. It is interesting to note that there had been boundary extensions before this one to be proposed. There was one in 1949 when the city acquired the airfield and the Milson suburb. Again in 1953, when Awapuni became part of the city. There were minor adjustments in 1961, but nothing further happened for some years, and after considerable debate and discussion, when the land that the city wished to utilise in Flyger's Line was thoroughly rejected by the Kairanga County Council, and a compromise was reached in 1967, which resulted in the suburb of Aukatere becoming within the city boundary. It was through this period that all principal streets were reconstructed, traffic engineering was introduced along with parking meters, traffic lights, and all the associated signs that one gets used to. The airport was upgraded, the runway resealed, and plans for its extension begun. A new dam at Tiritia was completed in 1957, this time at a height of 100 feet, one of the largest local body engineering contracts undertaken by any authority within the Manawatu. A new water treatment plant was also constructed, and the quality of the city's water supply greatly improved. After 60 odd years, the old septic tanks in Awapuni, which you recall were put there in 1905, were totally inadequate, and one of the most modern sewage treatment plants of its time was constructed in 1968 at a cost of $1 million. Gas continued to be provided, but with the advent of natural gas in 1970, a new era in profitability began. There were also some dramatic changes in our recreational activity with the completion of Memorial Park in 1953 and the development of Ongli and Manawaroa parks. The Lido Swimming Centre was built in 1966, and as the city further developed with suburban development, six more suburban parks were established. The major activity of citywide significance, of course, was the purchase of the showgrounds in 1974 and the development that was about to commence from that period. On the cultural side, the new library building was opened in 1965. We had a go at upgrading the Opera House in the mid-50s. The art gallery was established in temporary premises and finally relocated to its present site in 1977. The museum was established in Amesbury Street in 1971 and then moved, dare I say, to temporary premises in Church Street in 1974. Another milestone of this period, of course, was the removal of the railway from the central city to Tremaine Avenue in 1964, and that, of course, led to the acquisition of the old railway yards and the proposition that a complex of civic buildings could be established on this site. By 1970, a design had been chosen, and after much public debate over the cost of the project and the fact that it was to be sited over the roadway, construction was well underway by the city centenary in 1977. The city was simultaneously experiencing a period of rapid economic growth, and multi-storey commercial buildings were springing up in the central business district. So in the final 12 years since then, the Civic Centre was completed in 1980 at a cost of $10.7 million. The Globe Theatre was 2 years later added to this site. And we've seen many other major buildings, such as the stadium and the grandstand and the State Insurance and Westmark property buildings, just to name a few, and that have become city landmarks. Although less spectacular and obvious, there has been a considerable shift in emphasis to both community and economic development, and the renewal and upgrading of so many of the city's facilities that had been established in earlier years. Palmerston North has come a long way since it was a small and isolated bush village. The first mayor and councillors were people of vision who responded to the challenge of creating a community where none existed. And although I do not propose to use this occasion to speak of the future, I can and do note that similar characteristics will be required of the new council from November 1989 and onwards. I would now like to conclude with an expression of sincere thanks to all here present, former mayors, my deputy mayor, Councillor Bernard Ford, councillors and former councillors, staff and former staff members, and all others present today who, by reason of their being here, have had some significant connection with the present city administration. I believe that the city is in excellent shape. That it is so is entirely due to you all. And I hand it over without regret to the next administration and with the gratitude for having had the opportunity of being part of it. I now have pleasure in moving that this council formally express its appreciation of the services rendered to the city of Palmerston North by past mayors, councillors and staff. The motion will be seconded by Councillor Bernard Ford.
Seconded.
Those in favour will say aye. Aye. Contrary, no. The motion is carried. I now invite Councillor Ford, the Deputy Mayor, to reply on behalf of past mayors and councillors.
Yeah, Your Worship, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. I received a note to speak for a brief period here this evening, and when I looked at the note, I thought, that's not issued according to standing orders,
And then just
now we've had a motion moved, seconded, and passed, and I'm allowed to speak to it. So clearly we are running under a quite different system, either that or His Worship is slipping, and that seems unlikely. But it's with pleasure that I find I'm speaking on behalf of past and present councillors and mayors as well, because there have been a very able group of councillors and mayors during the period that the city has been here. I didn't speak earlier this evening at the final council meeting. I think I was the only one who didn't, because I was aware I was going to be asked to speak here. And while I'm not one of the more loquacious members of council, I thought that the councillors would probably be reluctant to hear me speak twice. So it wasn't with any lack of courtesy or thoughtfulness that I didn't speak. It was really that I had another opportunity. The council has been in existence, as the mayor has said, since 1877. There have been 228 men and 8 women served during that time, a very large number, but some have served for quite long periods, and I'm delighted to see Councillor Kelleher here tonight, or former Councillor Kelleher, who I can't call him by any other name. I have always known him as Councillor Kelleher, even when I was on his traffic committee and perhaps a little rebellious. But he has the record with 30 years, and I would just like to recall Councillor Spring, Dave Spring, who was a very long-serving councillor and my predecessor as chairman of the planning committee, and a very wise tutor in how to persuade planning committees to perhaps see things the chairman's way at times, Wana. Also, I recall when the Director of Community Services position was coming up, and the council was only just perhaps grasping the nettle of how to deal with community development, and I recall it came up 3 times, and the first 2 times Dave Spring said, I don't think we're going to make it tonight, I think we should just pull back. The message was, try and avoid ever having a reverse against you. If you don't think you're going to succeed, regroup. And it's wise advice. During the time, since 1877, there have been a great range of occupations among councillors. I see retailers topped the list with 39. Manufacturers were next. Accountants and share brokers at 15. There have been 17 lawyers, and I had the privilege of 3 of them on the planning committee at once, at one stage. And without enumerating who they were, I as a complete layman, of course, used to be a little amused when a legal matter came up and one of the brethren would perhaps sketch the legal horizon and the far landscape. Another one would give a fairly quick opinion, and another one who was quite familiar with the law often in the particular areas would give the definitive statement, and on we went. Fortunately, they didn't gang up on the chairman, and it was not too difficult. 10 councillors, of course, have become MPs over the years, and it may well happen again. But what I would like to comment on particularly has been the quality of councillors, certainly over the time I have been a member of council, and I know it applies way before that time as well. They've been hard-working, generally cohesive. The civic complex debate was perhaps an example where there was less cohesion than there had been, but eventually we worked it through. As chairman of the committee which was responsible for the construction, and it was a matter of some controversy, I had to bear the brunt of being cross-examined by Trevor DeClean and others who were not altogether in favour of the project, but we got it through. And I know other councillors have made many friends. There's a real camaraderie among councillors, and councillors have trusted one another. I was grateful and for the trust which was put in me to undertake one or two things I was interested in as a young councillor, and I was interested that Councillor Mahari tonight mentioned that he had found a similar spirit during his time on this council. There have been some very robust debates at times. Pat Kelleher complained that they weren't as robust of recent years as they used to be, and that was a pity. Depending on where you were in the robustness, this was a good idea or perhaps not a good idea. The Cowtree issue simmered and festered for quite some time. It has finally, I think, come to an end. The bridge issue was the matter which first drew me to a council meeting. It was standing room only. There were people sitting all over the floor in the horseshoe table. And eventually the fire brigade said that you can't have more than 120 in that room, and in future you'll have to have rather less than they had been having. One of the more recent innovations that the council has followed has been the emphasis on community development. I think His Worship indicated the way in which the council has evolved in its thinking, in the physical plant that it installed over the years, but it has evolved also in its community development role, and also in the direct development of reserves, and perhaps more recently the walkway. And I'm delighted to see two of the stalwart members of the walkway committee here tonight, and no doubt Lex Bartlett will feel reasonably safe with the progress we're making at the present time. We've been many experiences. I recounted the other day, but I think it perhaps bearing worth recounting again, the time when, as one of your representatives on the United Council, the bailiffs came into the council chamber over there and served us all with writs. A little statement at the bottom saying the cost of service of this is $250. And when I inquired from Brian Elwood whether this was for everybody or each, he gave me the news that it was each. And I sort of resolved at the time that it would be a long while before anyone got $250 out of me for that purpose. We've had other adventures along the way. The Attaway Reserve was essentially leased at the cost of four cans of beer and a concession by the Planning Committee Chairman. And then, having sealed it, the deal with these four cans of beer one Sunday morning, we then went mushrooming. Gordon Brown had considerately brought a little bucket for mushrooms. And when the business was finished, now Sir Alan Stewart and I and the late John Bolton and Gordon Brown went off to collect mushrooms. And when I inquired as to it was good to have mushrooms. But the reason this was being done was that Gordon, as deputy mayor, had been mushrooming on the Massey property and had been found by the farm manager and ordered off. And Gordon felt that if he was in the company of the Vice-Chancellor, we would probably not get ordered off. And Alan Stewart thought that we probably wouldn't, and we weren't. On another planning occasion, a number of us, including Jim Rowe, who went on to higher things elsewhere, were testing the noise from a sawing machine down in Matapo Street. And so we went down one morning about 7:30 and stood in the bedroom of the police house, which was nearest to the offending warehouse, and listened, and then solemnly adjudicated having listened. Some years later, I was invited socially to this house and commented to the host that, oh yes, I was in the bedroom of this house some years ago, and this member of the constabulary was most puzzled. I then enlightened him. Then rather later, of course, had episodes down in Monrad Street with a social club. And I perhaps give this as an example of what councillors won't be doing, because we're now told we're going to deal with policy. And for those who aren't sure what that is, I'm indebted to Dr. Waters for an anecdote which he told some years ago, where he said that a rabbit was tired of being shot at and trapped and generally life made miserable. And so he consulted his friend Owl, who was very wise, and said, well, I'm tired of being harassed by dogs and people chasing me with guns and what have you. Have you any suggestion as to how I might do something about this? And Owl thought for a while and said, yes, I think if you turned yourself into a weasel, you'd find that you wouldn't be chased like that and life would be more pleasant. And so the rabbit went off hoppity-skip and thought about this for a while and came back the following day and said to Owl, well, that was a very good suggestion you gave me last night, but I'm not sure how to go about it. And Al said, I don't bother with details, I stick to policy. Now, one of the non-policy issues we had in Manapo Street was securing a conviction for undue noise. And of course, one secures a conviction by obtaining evidence. And because the group who were disturbing the neighborhood posted sentries, it was difficult to get nearby to gather evidence. And so Dave Stroud and I, well, I on a number of occasions, and Dave Stroud also on a number of occasions, found we had to go across country through a whole lot of backyards at about 3 a.m. in order to get close enough so that Dave's little noise meter could take these noise readings and he could whisper into a dictaphone so that we got the right, all without being seen. And as we sort of clambered across country, in the middle of the night, I kept saying to Dave, gee, I hope those residents have got this sorted out, because if we're caught going across country in backyards at 3 a.m, one could be misconstrued. And then to cap it all, having got into the court, the district court judge fell over his lawnmower and finished up in hospital with a broken leg. And so justice had to be delayed while the judiciary recovered. And this was certainly a case of justice delayed would be justice denied. And I was getting midnight and 4 a.m. phone calls, and my wife was objecting. And so we, in conjunction with Ken Tremaine and one or two others, approached the court registrar for justice. And he said, justice is immutable. You will have to wait till the judge recovers and just carry on. And so so we said, well, why not have a hearing up in the hospital? Nope. Couldn't have a hearing in the hospital, you'll just have to carry on. So the late Mr. Harold Wall interceded. He was one of those who was suffering some of the noise. And we found the district court judge was quite happy to have a hearing in the hospital. So we went back to the court registrar and said, aha, we solved that, what's the next problem? And so the hearing was held, the judge was in traction and so forth, but it all worked. But that is no longer to be, because we're now, the future councillors, whoever they are, will concentrate on policy. And policy, I don't suppose, has you approving shifting houses at 10 in the night in the lights of two cars or this other sort of thing. So I'd like to conclude, rather longer probably that I was asked to speak, but nevertheless, without standing orders, the mayor is almost powerless. I would like to conclude this response to the motion already passed by just reiterating again my tribute to past councillors, but also to past staff. There's no question about the quality of staff who have served this council in the past and have served this council now. I vividly remember the late Peter Hall, the respect with which he was held, and Dave Spring saying at municipal conferences, he always remarked on how town clerks from elsewhere would seek out Peter Hall for his advice. So I just conclude by paying tribute once again to past councillors and past mayors and past staff, and finally wish those who are standing for election well in the elections. It isn't long to wait, but I have great pleasure now in having responded. Thank you.
I now invite the Town Clerk, Mr. M.J. Harding, to reply on behalf of past and present staff members.
Your Worship, the Mayor, Councillor Ford, councillors, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to respond to the Council's resolution on behalf of the staff, both past and present. In some ways, it is fitting that I should do this, because the position of Town Clerk is the only staff appointment that has continuously existed throughout the borough and city's 112 years history. It is interesting to traverse those 112 years from a staff perspective. The first staff appointed in August 1877 were Robert Keeling, a local valuer and accountant, who was appointed part-time town clerk and returning officer, salary £75 per annum. 2 years later, in 1879, his appointment became full-time. Robert Henderson, a local contractor, was appointed works overseer and inspector of nuisances on a full-time basis. And four roadmen or labourers were engaged at 7 and 6 pence per day. The salaries and wages for those for that first financial year totaled £324 for the council's six employees. By way of contrast, the council's salary and wage bill for the last financial year amounted to $20.7 million for some 750 employees. Not only does that represent 112 years inflation, but more importantly, 112 years progress. Because during this time, as the borough grew, so did the council's functions. Originally, the council was involved mainly with road making and stormwater drainage. Later, the council provided such amenities as public water supply, sewage disposal, public library, opera house, gas supply, abattoir, public transport service, electricity supply, an airport, town planning services, community development, promotion of economic development, and this building, the convention centre. With the expansion of the council's functions came a large staffing structure, which grew into the present nine separate departments. As indicated earlier, the town clerk was the first salaried employee. Robert Keeling was town clerk for 30 years and was followed by William Collingwood, James Hardy, 37 years, Peter Hall, Peter Apthorpe, and now the sixth and last town clerk, Martin Harding. The first two treasurers were councillors or members of the public and were paid an honorarium. This situation continued until 1901, when the position of treasurer was merged with that of town clerk. From 1944, the office of city treasurer again became a separate position and has subsequently been held by five officers. During that time, Keith Wilby has been the longest serving treasurer with 18 years service. John Metcalf, a former city treasurer, later became a city councillor, and the position is currently held by Steve Patterson. The first full-time librarian was appointed in 1900, one Charles Short, with 22 years service, and has been followed by six subsequent librarians. It is interesting to note that in the 1930s, Frederick Christian was succeeded by his wife, Ethel Christian. Recently retired Ian Malcolm held the post for 20 years. The city's early engineers were local consultants employed by the council on a commission basis for separate projects. The first full-time professional engineer was appointed in 1904. There have been five subsequent engineers, including Neil Johansson, Alan Vickers, and currently Gary Goodman. The city's gardens and parks or reserves were initially maintained by the Inspector of Works and the Borough Engineer. The first full-time curator of reserves was appointed in 1907. There have been five subsequent holders of this office with nearly as many changes of title. Peter Black served for 38 years. We have a rose garden in the Esplanade, is named after a former director, Dougal Mackenzie, and the current director is Lex Bartlett. The council purchased the local gasworks in 1915, and there have been subsequently eight gas managers, with the recently retired Ted Williams holding the office for 28 years. That post is now held by Dave Kubrick. The public transport service started in 1921 under the watchful eye of the borough engineer. This post has been held by eight bus managers, and the recently retired John Galbraith holding the office for the past 19 years. In 1923, the first city electrical engineer was appointed to supervise the construction of the powerhouse and reticulation of electricity in the borough. The current city electrical engineer, Ron McInnes, is the fifth holder of this position. The last of the council's departments was established in 1973. Prior to that, planning was a function of the city engineer's department. Ken Tremaine, whom I'm sure you'll all know, is the second city planner and is the longest serving of the current departmental heads, with 13 years to his credit. A full list of all departmental heads, together with their years of service, is listed as a supplement in tonight's order paper. Many of these names will be familiar to you, either personally or as a street name of the city. Take a moment or two to browse through this list, and you'll realise that every day you drive in your motor car along the history of your city. I'd now like to refer to some of the council's longer serving staff members. There have been thousands of employees on the council's payroll since 1877, some with a remarkable length of service. Five have served the council for 50 years or more. Jim Hardy, Frank Mabey, Ernie Sutton, Charlie Waugh. But the record is held by Arthur Matthews with 54 years and 5 months service to this council. Arthur served this council for almost half of its existence. 20 have given more than 40 years service. Of these long-serving officers, 4 still reside in Palmerston North. And I would like to make special mention of Mr. Jack Learmonth, who is able to be present here this evening. Jack served the council for almost 46 years, and it is interesting to note that he joined the gas department the year after his father was appointed as gas manager. No doubt he was the best candidate for the position. There are numerous other families that have worked for the council, and in particular, there are 2 families that have a remarkable service record with this council. First, there is the Toms family, of which 6 members have given 134 years service. However, the record is held by the Walker family, with 9 members of the family contributing a total of 149 years service to this council during its 112-year history. What is probably unique in New Zealand local government history is that 3 generations, father, son, and grandson, all with the same Christian name, George, have consecutively held the position of sexton, spanning a period of some 64 years. The Walker family is represented here this evening by none other than Mr. George Walker. In conclusion, Your Worship, I thank the council for its record of appreciation, and I pay tribute to all past and present employees of this council over the last 112 years.
Councillors, the last item on the order paper is simply a reference to a stone that has been commissioned to be placed adjacent to that affixed to the wall at the foot of the stairs leading to the council chamber in a similar style to that which is there and which recorded the centennial history, namely the names of the first councillors and the names of the then current councillors. This one, in a slightly abbreviated form, will commemorate the abolition of the Palmerston North City and the dissolution of the Palmerston North City Council as at the 31st of October 1989, and will record the names of the members. I hope that that will be in place about the time that the new council is able to be formed. Councillors and ladies and gentlemen, there being no further business, I now declare this meeting closed.
Ladies and gentlemen, after the party on the stage leave the hall, would you please make your way downstairs where refreshments, dessert and coffee will be served. Would you please be upstanding for the mayor?